This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. American history books are filled with stories of segregation, racism, and oppression in the rural South. So were there any cases where whites and blacks worked together and challenged the system? Yes, and Robert Hunt Ferguson has documented one. Robert is a professor of history at Western Carolina University, and his new book uncovers a little-known story of a pair of cooperative farms in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. In the midst of the Depression and under the repressive system of Jim Crow, 24 families, black and white, lived, worshipped, and farmed in peace on the principles of cooperative communalism. The project survived for 20 years. The book is called Remaking the Rural South, Interracialism, Christian Socialism, and Cooperative Farming in Jim Crow, Mississippi. And Robert Hunt Ferguson joins me now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hello, Rob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us more about this experiment that ultimately became two farms.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 1933, U.S. Congress passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which was supposed to level out nosediving crop prices. It essentially paid large-scale farmers to remove a section of land out of production. The problem was the federal government was entering into a contract with large-scale farm owners. They assumed that they were also the people who were working the land, which was, you know, far from the case. So large-scale farmers in the South received a subsidy from the federal government for removing a portion of land out of production, but they also got rid of their sharecroppers. And so not only were sharecroppers fired from their jobs, but sharecroppers were in an unusual situation because they also lived on the land. And so when they were fired, they were also kicked out of their homes. And by the end of 1933 and into 1934, what you have are these refugee tent communities popping up in Missouri and western Tennessee and Arkansas and Mississippi, where these sharecroppers are living in the worst conditions possible.
So how did the idea for this particular cooperative come together?
Well, around 1934, 1935, the plight of these sharecroppers became national news. Several important politicians began to take notice and advocate for some sort of amelioration for the sharecroppers. The federal government also documented through photographs the sharecroppers on the side of the road. Dorothea Lange came through in the 1930s and photographed the sharecroppers. And so for a time, there was a sort of cause célèbre going on with the sharecroppers. Several people who had the various ears in the federal government proposed solutions to what to do with the sharecroppers. One of the solutions was to buy up large tracts of land in the rural South and relocate these sharecroppers to that land so they could go on farming, doing what they had done all their lives, and hopefully compete with some of these larger plantations without the sort of oppressive labor practices and oppressive racial practices that had gone on the plantations.
So when they formed this co-op, and we'll talk about the individuals who came together and the particular philanthropy that all came together for the project that you're talking about, but the one step we have to take back is this ultimately is a story about ownership, right? Because as you point out, there is never in the Deep South the idea of the plantation owners sipping their umbrella drinks on the porch. These are corporations, large scale corporations that are massively abusing labor and the land, and it's been going on this way for decades. So when anyone as vulnerable as a sharecropper who doesn't own the land they're on finds themselves in a situation like a depression, they're simply out because they never owned anything, right?
That's correct, yes. And the idea was to change that story for these sharecroppers. Delta Cooperative Farm was the first farm. It was founded in 1936. And the idea was that residents of the farms would be members of the cooperative, and that over time they would build up equity in the farm, and that eventually they would own it outright. The corporate plantations that you talk about one of the neighbors of Delta Cooperative Farm was the Delta Pine and Land Company, which farmed tens of thousands of acres. It was the largest cotton producing plantation in Mississippi at the time. And here is a 2,000-acre farm running on a cooperative model, on a socialist model, and trying to compete with these huge plantations, which, as you point out, are essentially corporations. And it was an uphill battle for them.
So who are the individuals? Let's talk about some of the people who came together to create this co-op, because not only is it a cooperative business model, as you say, competing with these large corporations, but also it's going to be a social model as well, and therefore somewhat dangerous in the Deep South. Tell us more about who comes together to make this happen.
Yeah, so the first group of people who really suggest this idea for the farms that I write about, they were members of a labor union, the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, that was organized first in Arkansas and began to spread around the South, mostly the Deep South. They were in close contact with the sharecroppers who were in these refugee communities on the sides of roads up and down the Mississippi River Valley. But the Southern Tenant Farmers Union was mainly broke and had no money to buy up thousands of acres of land and relocate these farmers. And so they reached out to several philanthropists who were in tune with the plight of the sharecroppers, foremost of which was a man named Sherwood Eddy, who was a missionary with the YMCA and had traveled the world and had seen poverty firsthand all over the world. And when he got to the Mississippi Delta, he said, "This is poverty on par with what I've seen, you know, traveling all over." It was lucky for the Southern Tenant Farmers Union that Sherwood Eddy also had a trust fund. And so he was able to dig into that trust fund and personally footed the bill for the first farm. The first manager of the farm had also been a missionary with the Presbyterian Church. He had been in Japan, where he had lived and worked on a cooperative farm in Japan, and was a close personal friend of Sherwood Eddy's, and came back to the South. He was a Southerner. He was from rural Tennessee. And Sherwood Eddy approached him about being the first manager of the farm.
Where did the idea? When did the idea of an interracial farm come up? Because it seems to me it's one thing to say we need to do something about the poverty inflicted by the Depression and this decision to eject sharecroppers. But to break the ironclad law of Jim Crow and white supremacy seemed to be a far step. Whose decision was that, and who participated in this?
That mainly came, this idea of interracialism mainly came from, initially from the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. The organizers of the union were socialists, and so their preference for interracialism was both ideological but highly practical. It made no sense whatsoever to have two different unions, one for white and one for black. It made no sense whatsoever to have two different farms, one for white and one for black. And so the people who participated in this were the sharecroppers. Initially, most of them were members of the union. The union members would go out to these refugee tent communities and essentially recruit the ones they felt were in the worst conditions to relocate to the farms. And in some cases, they recruited them right off the plantations, which was often a very tenuous practice. And some people were threatened with violence in the process of moving all their belongings to these new interracial socialist farms.
How did they – how was it – we're going to talk about these two farms that existed for another 20 years. How is it that they were able to form in the first place, given the threat that they posed to white supremacy and Jim Crow?
I think the major context is the Great Depression. The Depression was, of course, devastating economically, but also socially. A lot of Americans were questioning some long-held beliefs about American society and certainly about capitalism. And so there was this moment of opportunity. I call it a moment of modification in the book, but a moment of opportunity for Americans not only to question sort of long-held beliefs about how things operated politically, socially, economically, but also to try to enact new ways of doing things. This allowed the American Socialist Party, it allowed for labor unions to not only recruit a lot of members, but to go about trying to do something radical like Delta Cooperative Farm.
How did it tell us what they grew and about how successful they were? Because, as you say, it's a very competitive environment, and they're at a disadvantage mm-hmm. because of their scale.
That's right. The first farm was not all that successful, economically speaking. It operated in the red. They mostly grew cotton because they did see themselves as trying to compete with plantations in the area. But they were behind from the very founding. They broke ground in March of 1936, which was late in the planting season already in Mississippi. In January of 1937, they experienced one of the most devastating floods that swept through the Mississippi Valley. And so the first farm really wasn't all that successful. The second farm was founded in 1940, also in rural Mississippi, but in a different county. And that farm tried to learn from the successes of the first farm, mitigate the failures of the first farm. They diversified the crops they grew. Still, they grew cotton, but they also grew alfalfa. They had a dairy. They sold excess timber. They had a cooperative store, a medical clinic, and a federal credit union, all of which brought in money to the cooperative effort.
What was the atmosphere on the farm? It's one thing to aspire to this kind of interracialism, another to enact it, given the long history of race relations in the South. How did it work out?
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting in reading the personal accounts of the people who lived on the farms was that you could read these experiences on just about any small community anywhere in America. A lot of the residents were concerned about their income. They were concerned about labor and making sure that their families were comfortable. They were concerned with being treated fairly. Some of the families moved to the farms with children. Eventually, some of the children fell in love and were married on the farms, and they had kids. And reading the letters from the nurses and the doctor who worked at the medical clinic, the people who were coming to the medical clinic were dealing with all sorts of things that most rural Americans dealt with in the 1930s and 1940s. So really, the day-to-day lives were not so different from most rural Americans at the time. They just happened to be involved in this really heady endeavor that challenged, racial hierarchy and challenged, a long-held way of doing things in the South.
And as you point out in the book, particularly in the poorer rural communities, there was already some history of cooperation that mm-hmm. that was required just because the communities were too small to be inflexible about the rules of Jim Crow.
That's right. There were some labor unions who had histories of interracial cooperation. In the rural South, race relations were much more malleable than in, say, the urban South. No less dangerous and certainly no less violent, but malleable in a different way than in the urban South. And so there was a legacy of cooperation that the residents of the farm could draw on. And certainly there were legacies of African-American activism in the rural South that lots of the black residents of the farms drew upon in order to last for 20 years as they did.
You talk in the book about many of the pressures that ultimately led to the end of the co-op, including new technologies, the need for fewer and fewer farm laborers, the Great Migration, lots of other pressures. But talk about the final blow and also some of the pressures as the KKK and surrounding white communities became mm-hmm. more aggressive.
They did. The twin context of the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movement really affected the farms in a very specific way. In the 1950s, anti-communism was, of course, rampant. There was a massive resistance to the successes of the Civil Rights Movement beginning in the 1950s, especially after the passage of Brown v. Board of Education. But in 1955, Emmett Till was kidnapped and murdered less than 30 miles from the second farm that I write about, just the next county over. A little over a month later, the two men who were accused of kidnapping and murdering him were acquitted by an all-white jury. A few mornings later, just down the road from the farm, a pickup truck with several black teenagers in the truck rode past a school bus, and one of the teenagers yelled out from the truck, "Hey, sugar, you look good to me," in the direction of several girls who were standing at the bus stop. There were several African-American girls. There were several white girls at the bus stop. For whatever reason, an 11-year-old white girl assumed that he was talking to her. She began to cry, got on the bus. The bus driver inquired, then told the principal, and the principal called the sheriff. In the end, this one incident in the context of anti-communism, in the context of the civil rights movement, in the context of the murder of Emmett Till, signaled the end of the farms, because that teenager was questioned by the sheriff about Providence Farm. The 11-year-old girl lived on the farm with her family. The black teenager had frequented the farm, gone to social events in the community, had shopped at the cooperative store, and all the questions were about Providence. What goes on there? Are whites and blacks allowed to swim together in the pond? Do they dance together at socials? Have you ever heard the phrase racial equality? And there was a large community meeting called that night. This is a community of 1,000 people just down the road from the farms. 500 people showed up. The other 500 were at the football game. This was a Friday mm-hmm. night. Mm-hmm. And by a near unanimous showing of hands, the two farm managers were, it was demanded that they leave Mississippi. As they were leaving the meeting, one of their neighbors, who they had known for almost 20 years, said, "What we need for these two SOBs is a couple of grass ropes." So right then and there, in the parking lot of the high school, they were threatened with lynching.
Robert Hunt Ferguson, I have left you no time to talk about the legacy, but there is some fallout and a kind of genealogy that does follow after the collapse. And for that, you'll have to read the book, which you can find out about at our website, stateofthings.org. In the meantime, Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
He is a history professor at Western Carolina University. The book is called Remaking the Rural South, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.